Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, March 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk about the great outdoors. We welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy serves as the game management section for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He facilitates research, outreach, and management planning for New York's big game, small game, middle game, fur-bearing wildlife. Joining Jeremy today is DEC wildlife biologist Michael Muthersbaugh. Mike coordinates the statewide Upland Game Bird Program. You want to call the show? Let's do it. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, Michael Muthersbaugh, and your wildlife questions coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing wildlife today, and we welcome back our pal Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the game management section head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, facilitating the research, outreach, and management planning for New York's big game, small game, and fur-bearing wildlife. Previously, he coordinated New York's management programs for white-tailed deer, black bear, and moose management programs. Also with us today is biologist Michael Muthersbaugh, a wildlife biologist with the DEC's Game Management Section. He coordinates the statewide Upland Game Bird Program, working with biologists and researchers across the state to manage wild turkey, ruffed grouse, propagated ring-necked pheasants, American woodcock. Mike studied bats and received a MS from Virginia Tech and studied white-tailed deer behavior and predatory prey ecology at Clemson for his PhD. Number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Let's start with the old-timer, Jeremy Hurst. How are you?
We're well.
How's it going?
It's going well. It's going to be a good spring.
So we talked a lot about the Sasquatch in the break, but I don't want to talk about that during the show today.
Fair enough.
But, I mean, I know you've seen them. Just shh, don't talk about it. Michael Muthersbaugh. That name I'm going to screw up 12 different times. That's French, right? Scandinavian?
German.
German, that's specific. Right.
Yep.
Kind of like Graf.
I'm not sure about that.
What do you mean you're not sure about it? That's my name, and I'll tell you.
Definitely German? Okay.
So what's happening, man? Nice to have you on the show.
How's it going?
Yeah, so tell me about this Upland Game Bird Program. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so we work with the turkey population, wild turkey population, and the ringneck pheasant program right now is really focused on the release of propagated pheasants that we rear.
What do you mean propagated?
Propagated just means you rear in captivity and then release them into the wild. And
to what end?
For harvest.
For harvest,
yep.
For hunting and such?
Correct, yep.
Ah, interesting. And how many do you release into the wild?
Last year, I believe it was around 43,000.
Yeah.
We were trying to get to that 50,000 number. And so most of this propagation, most of the rearing of the pheasants in the state occurs at Reynolds Game Farm.
Where's that?
Which is out just outside of Ithaca, just east of Ithaca. And that's on state public or public access properties. Other folks like game preserves are able to release ringneck pheasants on their properties too.
So pheasants, if you release enough of them, they still will not do their own thing and we will have a native population of pheasants?
Maybe a couple might make it through, and just like trout and stocking of trout, there may be a couple holdover birds, but wild, naturalized populations of ringneck pheasants are probably very rare in the state. If anything, out south of Rochester, really they need pretty specialized habitat.
Yeah, and what is that?
Grassland, native grasslands, you know, predominated by fire with a matrix of crops would be really ideal for them.
So where is their happy spot?
Iowa, Nebraska, up through the Dakota, even parts of the Dakotas now.
So why then would we want to let the hunters hunt here? Couldn't they go to Iowa and Nebraska and do it there?
Could, in theory, yeah. That's a cost, right?
Right.
And, it is a tradition that's been going on in New York for over 100 years now.
Was there a time when they were aplenty here on their own?
Yeah, probably. There was, now, even when they were, even when there was a natural, wild, self-sustaining population, we were still doing releases. There were still released, propagated birds.
How long has that been going on?
Propagation of pheasants, over 100 years.
I'll be darned.
Yep.
The big issue for pheasants is that, unlike trout, where we have good quality trout streams that trout can survive in the wild, we really don't have the habitat anymore in New York, at least in any great amount, for pheasants. Now, we did 50 years ago, and so there's a lot of folks out there that remember seeing wild pheasants, or at least pheasants that survived over, but it's pretty rare now.
So when you release them and they're flying around here, and if they're not getting shot, where do they go?
Well, actually, that's a good question. Most probably get depredated pretty quickly by hawks, foxes. Owls, foxes, you name it, dogs. they're not the best survivors. Propagated pheasants really never have been.
No.
And so it's provide a really good opportunity for new hunters to go through the mentoring process with adult seasoned hunters, and it's a great tool for training somebody how to become a safe and effective hunter.
Are they easy prey, pretty much, for a hunter?
Not necessarily easy, but they can be relatively easy to find, and so it's a different style of interactive hunting where you can be walking alongside a partner and flush a bird and have some activity rather than just sitting in a tree stand waiting for a deer. Mm. And so it's more engaging, and you get the firearms handling skills as well as some woodsmanship and some safe use of firearms. And so it's a great training opportunity for young hunters.
We're joined today by Jeremy Hurst and Michael Muthersbaugh of the New York State DEC. It's 800-348-2551. If you have a wildlife question, you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Want to get back to the turkey population. Jeff Werdick, the DEC, said we'll talk about woodcock today. We'll do that as well. But this email from Pete, who says, how serious is chronic wasting disease in whitetails in the northeastern U.S., and can you comment on the dangers of eating invasive pigs? No, I've not seen an invasive pig, but all right, what do you got?
Well, let's start with the whitetail deer.
Okay.
So great question about chronic wasting disease. This is a really big concern for deer managers nationally, certainly for deer managers in the Northeast and New York in particular. We're grateful that chronic wasting disease isn't spread throughout New England at the moment. Mm-hmm. Chronic wasting disease is pervasive in Pennsylvania. For background for folks, it's a prion abnormal protein disease that creates a central nervous problem for deer. It's 100% fatal. There's no vaccine, and it can be very difficult. Well, it's essentially difficult, if not impossible, to contain in a wild population. If the deer population is kept low and there is intensive removal of deer from the incident site where the disease is found, it's possible to contain it to some degree. But we've seen it spread. Every state and province that's had chronic wasting disease has seen it spread, with one exception, and that happens to be New York.
Why?
Well, we got lucky, I think, is what it came down to. So we've had chronic wasting disease twice in New York. And so, as I said, chronic wasting disease is present and pervasive in Pennsylvania, but it has not made its way into the Northeast much. We had a detection in New York in 2005 on a captive deer facility, and then we tested all the deer in that facility and some wild deer in the immediate vicinity, and we found it in, I think, a total of 5 captive and 2 wild deer. We did intensive removal of deer, harvesting those deer and sampling them in the immediate vicinity, and perhaps we got lucky and just contained it. Wiped it out for the moment.
It's a losing game ultimately, right?
If the disease gets established, it's a losing game. So we went then 2005, so almost 20 years until we had our second detection just this past fall. And again, on a captive facility. And so all those animals were tested by the Department of Agriculture and Market. And then we did some testing of wild deer in the vicinity, worked with hunters. It was just right at the onset of the hunting season. And so we collected a whole bunch of samples from hunters in the vicinity. And we're grateful that we did not find any chronic wasting disease in the wild deer in the area. But of course, it's of great concern, because anytime the disease agent is present, it could potentially spread to wild deer or other captive deer. And so we're going to continue our monitoring efforts there in that area, enhanced to that. We're testing every year all around the state, but of course, there where the disease was present locally, we're doing more.
Now, of more concern would be what? The avian flu, right?
Avian flu is widespread across the U.S. and New York right now as well. And so there's big implications for the avian flu for the poultry industry and even livestock industry. There's been some detections in cattle. And so wildlife managers and agriculturists are keeping a really close eye on high path avian influenza.
When you raise pheasants in this facility, and where did you say that was?
Reynolds Game Farm is okay. Just east of Ithaca.
Okay. When you raise those, this is not a concern for wild birds of that nature?
It is, actually. So they're quite closely related to fowl, chickens, and they seem to be among that family of birds, seem to get really affected by HPAI. And in 2023, actually, they had to depopulate the farm because HPAI got established in that captive flock before hunting season. It is definitely a big risk to have birds concentrated like that in the poultry industry. We have all these protocols in place to keep that farm as safe as possible so that that kind of thing never happens again, but it's always a risk.
We're joined today by Jeremy Hurst and Michael Muthersbaugh, and we will get to the phones in a moment. Just quickly, before we take our break and then hit the phones, 800-348-2551, you said you monitor the turkey population, right?
Correct.
How are we doing?
It's difficult to say, but I would say we might have that the decline that occurred in the population statewide from 2010 to 2020, let's say, seems to maybe have stabilized, actually. And then there are actually parts of the state that might see increasing populations of turkeys, like in the St. Lawrence Valley and even the Adirondacks. But there are parts of the state that seem to have a depressed population compared to what it was during the peak in the mid-2000s and around 2010.
That's so funny. And I know this has come up on the Bird Show from time to time. It does seem to be a very wide fluctuation because I can remember even in my neighborhood seeing numbers of these things.
Yep.
And now nothing. The last few years, I haven't seen anything.
Yep. Yeah, part of that is that flocks can move around, right? As habitat changes just ebb and flow, the natural ebb and flow of a flock, they may choose to roost in a different area, and you might not have them for a while, and then they might come back.
Let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551. It's Jeremy Hurst, Michael Muthersbaugh, and your calls coming up. Nothing to do with wildlife at all. That's just a nice one. That's Java. I think, what, Al Hurt on the trumpet there? I'm not sure. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff with you. It's Vox Pop. Michael Muthersbaugh and Jeremy Hurst join us. Let's go to the phones. You know it's going to be a good day when Merle is on the line. Hello, Merle in Argyle. How you doing, brother?
I'm walking around after cleaning up the kitchen. Now I'm ready.
All right, buddy. You're on.
All right. I called DEC last week, maybe, and I had picked up an owl off the side of the road and was wondering if they wanted to test it. They said, no, there's an outbreak of they're starving. Can you give me any follow-up?
I think Jeremy can disabuse you of that notion, Moyle. Go ahead.
Yeah, Merle. So right now, as we mentioned just a few minutes ago, New York's experiencing an outbreak of high-path avian influenza. This actually started in 2001 and been moving its way across the country. We've been seeing HPAI deaths or related deaths of a lot of birds.
Including owls?
Year, including owls.
So he shouldn't have picked this up.
Well, so that'll be the next step for everybody else here. So that's done. But the high-path avian influenza is, as we mentioned, really problematic for poultry. But we've been seeing a lot of deaths in waterfowl and birds of prey. And so lots of dead geese, lots of dead hawks and owls and eagles. And so it's possible that that was what caused this owl to die. Now, you found it by a roadside, I believe, which, of course, they could also
be
hit by cars.
Hit by a car.
Yeah, and that's very possible.
They said they're starving to death.
Well, that's possible, but not likely in this case. It might have just been a misunderstanding. But the high path avian influenza is the likely culprit if it wasn't a vehicle in this case. And just as a public service announcement for everyone else who might find dead wildlife, because we are seeing these birds in particular that are succumbing to the disease, there is some caution that you should exercise if you find these animals. We're not collecting them all for testing because the disease has been found very widespread across the state, maybe with rare exceptions for eagles. But we just ask that you, if you need to dispose of it, I would take a garbage bag and invert it, put your hand on the inside, and then collect the animal that way. And so you don't ever have to touch the carcass. Mm. If you need to use a shovel, you could bury it. But then just dispose of it in the normal waste stream. Make sure that you wash your hands and everything.
You put it out for the vultures. Well, but
yeah, and that actually may not be good because the scavengers could get the disease from feeding,
including mammals.
Carcass. Yeah, we've found high path in a muskrat, in a squirrel, and in a fox. There's been a number of other cases that were suspect, but certainly it's most common in birds.
Yeah, bury it deep, Merlin. Don't eat it, brother. Thank you for the call. 800-348-2551. You know, perception is a faulty thing. But in my neighborhood, I have never heard so many owls. They're everywhere. We had screech owls, barred owls, and it's been wonderful. The owl population seems robust in my neck of the woods.
Cool.
That's good.
You want to comment on it? Am I wrong?
They're probably doing well. I mean, they can be impacted by HPAI, as Jeremy said. They can be impacted by rodenticide. So birds of prey. So if folks are using a lot of heavy rodenticide.
That'll do that, huh?
I believe that can impact them.
But you're also just hearing them as they're gearing up for mating season.
Yep.
And so it's a fun time of year to be listening for barred owls. And if you're hearing screech owls, they're a lot of fun as well.
Yeah, good times. We're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Michael Muthersbaugh. How much fun are you having, Mike?
I'm having a good time.
Really?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Let's go to Steventown. Nancy, you're on. Oh, hey, Nancy.
Hello.
Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
Can you turn the radio down there, my friend?
I don't have the radio on.
Oh, then somebody has a great radio voice in your house. All right, go ahead.
Yes. I have this solo bird called a chukar partridge. I guess I looked him up. Are they sort of native to us, and he's by himself? When I have seen them, they've been in groups, so I was just curious to know more about them.
Nancy, can you confirm that describe what you're seeing? Because chukar partridge aren't native to New York. In fact, they're a long ways from home, if that's the case.
Yeah.
Well, I took a picture of it and Googled it, and that's what they told me.
Wow. I mean, is it possible that there's a stray?
Are they brought in? We have neighbors that have a hunting club.
Yeah.
Could they have been brought in for them?
There you go.
Yeah, that's probably where they came from. They are able to do releases of partridge just like we do with the pheasants.
So, interesting. Yeah. So that's probably what happened, Nancy.
Oh, so that he got loose or something.
Very likely.
Okay.
All right.
And he's been coming to our bird feeder, you know, to get all the seed.
Yep.
Okay. All
okay.
right. Just didn't know exactly who he was and what he was doing here, and, you know, curious about that. And I just would mention that we have quite a few wild turkeys around our area.
Yeah.
Down
in Steventown way. All right. Well, Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Now, if hunting clubs bring in these other, the chukar partridge or whatever, can that be a danger in propagating some of these, like the avian flu and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're always introducing potential risk whenever you introduce especially a propagated animal into the wild. This is why even wildlife rehabilitators need to make sure that animals are generally clear of disease before letting them go into the wild.
Yeah, and I'll add that in order to do the activity, you actually need to have a license from our agency. Yeah. And so it's not just freewheeling. Anybody wants to do it can. They need to apply for a license and do it through proper channels. And generally, the animals that are released, and even ours that we get for pheasants, are raised in tightly controlled environments from hatcheries. We don't raise the birds the same way that we used to. In fact, Mike mentioned high path avian influenza impacting our pheasant production. We changed things up dramatically. We're not actually hatching birds and raising them through their full life cycle on our farm, but we're buying birds that have already been hatched elsewhere at a commercial hatchery. We're bringing them in as juveniles and then raising them for the latter part of as they continue to mature, just so we can reduce the risk of having our birds be exposed on the landscape for as long before they're ready for release.
Now, I don't understand how exactly avian flu would propagate, but if you are in a situation where you have thousands of these things hatching and they're close together, isn't that just a recipe for propagation of a virus?
Yeah, it could be. What we're seeing with the high path outbreak this time is that it seems to be being spread by wild birds. And so, for instance, our farm is open air. All of our birds are under net, but they're in large pens. And so any goose that flies over that might be sick and defecates as they fly could be exposing those birds to the virus. Whereas in a commercial hatchery, it's all indoors, very tightly controlled with biosecurity. And so their risks are much more confined than ours would be.
We're joined today by Jeremy Hurst and Michael Muthersbaugh of the New York State DEC. It's Wildlife Today on the show, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And this one is from, doesn't say, says also. So this is from also. I read in the New York Outdoor News that there is no safe level for consuming migratory ducks. True or not true?
Well, there have been quite a number of studies that looked at contaminant loads that accumulate in migratory birds. I shouldn't say quite a few. There's been several.
Okay.
And the amount of heavy metals that might be present in a migratory bird depends on the species and generally on what they eat. And what we find with these species is that those toxins or those toxic metals will accumulate in the fat content more so than the muscle content. So whenever a hunter who takes migratory game birds is consuming them, we always recommend to clean off all the skin and the fat, which would be the reservoir of those toxins. And the meat is much higher quality. So there are some recommendations for limits on consumption, particularly some birds like mergansers, we would recommend no consumption. Other birds, which are divers and may feed on aquatic insects, they could bioaccumulate some of those toxins. Whereas other birds like geese or wood ducks are going to be less likely to accumulate some of those toxins and have much cleaner meat, and so they could be consumed more readily.
Mike?
Nothing to add there.
The number here is 800-348-2551. This from an anonymous listener. Is it illegal to bait deer in New York State? If yes, how would someone report a family member who may be baiting deer? I've heard this third hand, and someone said my family member was sighted already. Well, there's trouble in that family. If I found evidence of baiting still happening, can I report it anonymously?
Absolutely. And so, yes, the first answer is yes, it is illegal to bait deer. It's illegal to feed deer. It's illegal to hunt over bait. And so these are all measures of fair chase, as well as to reduce the negative impacts that happen when people are feeding deer, both ecologically and biologically for the deer. And I wish I could remember the number, but we have a toll-free tip line. I think it's 1-800-TIP-DEC, or I'm going to get this wrong, and so you'll have to look on our website. But this it's anonymous, and you can report any environmental violation, whether that be deer feeding or air quality problems.
Is that an ethical dilemma to drop a dime on a family member?
I think I'll leave that to the family member to decide.
Fredo, I knew it was you. All right, let's go to Gregory in Hyde Park. Gregory, you're on.
Hello. I was just wondering, is bird flu always fatal to any bird that contracts it? And if so, if it's not, over time, do they develop herd immunity?
So it's not always fatal. In fact, Jeremy mentioned that a lot of waterfowl were dying because of HPAI in New York right now, but they are mostly reservoirs, actually. Most of the ducks that get it probably don't die. Now, some species pretty much get wiped out by it, like pheasants. Probably very few make it through that. Grouse would probably be in that category. Chickens. So if you have backyard poultry flocks, wash your hands if you clean up a dead owl off the street.
Interesting.
And but yeah, and I'm not sure about the herd immunity. There are different strains, just like COVID. There are different strains of the virus. So this is a unique strain. I don't know about the herd immunity question.
Have you guys vaccinated any birds? Done any experimentation? No, I'm not kidding.
No, no. I know that Cornell was testing live birds back in the fall. They were testing live birds that were caught as part of other research projects.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Okay. Gregory, you want to follow up?
No, I'm pretty clear, but I do have one other quick question.
Sure.
Some friends of mine, my friends live on a lake, and they saw ducks. I saw it too, but ducks perching in a tree. Not perching, but actually on a large branch that was kind of flat, so they might not have had to actually perch. But they were standing in a tree. Is that something that is that actually occurs commonly? Or
there's actually several species of ducks that nest in trees.
Yeah.
No way.
And so wood ducks and hooded, wood ducks and hooded mergansers will nest in tree cavities. Mm-hmm. And it is pretty wild to see them fly up in the tree and land on a branch or just right into the cavity. And then even more so in the spring when the chicks are born and have to jump from that tree cavity.
20 to 30 feet.
Down to the ground and then walk some distance, half mile, to an open water.
Wow.
Fascinating. Hey, look, there's a spider on the phone here. That's a good luck. All right, Gregory, before I get bitten by the spider, we're going to let you go. 800-348-2551 is the number. That's right, Zach. There's a spider. It looks vicious. It's about the size of a half a dime. I think we're going to be okay. Let's go to Barry in Bernardston. You're on.
Yes, hello there.
Hi.
So we have a deck outside, and on the deck is a outdoor grill. The grill has a cover on it. When my wife and I stepped outside yesterday, we saw that some animal had actually removed the cover from the grill, so it was just sort of draped over the side. There was no damage to it. I thought it was a black bear. My wife thought, well, there's no tear marks or claw marks. The only other animal that makes its way onto our deck was a possum. But I don't believe a possum could actually do that. So wondered what your thoughts were, if in fact it could have been a very gentle bear.
A very civilized bear as well. All right, what do you think, fellas?
Hey, boo-boo.
Yeah, it could have been a gentle bear and a very nice, courteous nuisance bear.
Or it could have been the wind.
It could have been the wind or a raccoon.
A raccoon might do that too, yeah?
Yeah, so either way, grease traps on drills are an attractive for bear. And I'm surprised if it were a bear that it actually hadn't ripped it open because really you're talking about like a little candy bar wrapper for the bear. He can just rip that thing apart and find the grease trap. And that's not all that uncommon. And so if you have bears in your area, they are now starting to come out of dens. And so we will anticipate that bears will be making their way around residential neighborhoods and finding the bird feeders that are still up, finding grease traps on grills that are being used. And so it's our responsibility then to take care of that and reduce that attractant, clean up the grill, clean out your grease trap, make sure you're not feeding pets outside because it'll create problems for bears.
All right, Barry, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. So this is the time around these parts for bear. Is there a timetable? Because I know people have called in the bird show maybe in the last month, further south from Albany, and they've already mentioned the bears.
Yeah, there's been bear sightings in the area already. And, you know, it varies from year to year. But generally what happens is the adult males come out first. Then we'll have females that have bears that were born a year ago. So they're 1 year old now, and they were in the den with the female. They'll come out next. And then any bear, or any female bear that's had cubs that were born in the den this year will probably be in a little bit longer yet. But there's no reason that they need to come to stay in there. We've got skunk cabbage that's starting to poke through. There's going to be some other vegetation coming up quickly. There's lots of grasses that bears will be feeding on. But they do create problems when people aren't used to it, right? And they still got bird feeders and they've been putting their garbage out in the curb the night before. They're basically setting the store for bears to make a mess.
So you're strongly in the bear defender category. It's humans' fault most of the time.
Well, bears are just feeding. They're doing what's opportunistic and easy for them. And if we set a dinner plate for them, it's a lot easier to get 2,000 calories in a quick snack from a bird feeder than it is to dig around in the ground and find some roots and some grasses.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. Zach, the engineer, let's take a break here. You can email voxpop@wamc.org if you wish. Michael Muthersbaugh. I had some trepidation about saying the name, but I think I've gotten it correctly. Jeremy Hurst is with us as well. We'll be back. Jeff Beck, Beck Spolero here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the DEC already. Michael Muthersbaugh. See, I screwed it up. You know what? I shouldn't have mentioned it. It's just Mike. We'll just call him that. Jeremy Hurst is here as well. So, Jeff Warnick said, listen, you got to talk about the woodcock. So, all right. Have at it, fellas.
Woodcock are an awesome. They're actually a shorebird. And they are a game species here in New York, so you can harvest them in the fall.
What do they look like?
Oh, they are a funky-looking bird, by all accounts, at least. Long, straight bill, pretty small, only about 7 ounces, give or take.
It's a game bird?
Seven ounces?
How much meat is on there?
Well, they're mostly breast.
Okay.
Pretty powerful flyers, so I think they have a good bit of meat for their body size. Long, straight bill. Really good for probing the soil, looking for worms in some soft, rich soils. Mm-hmm. Eyes that are real set far, far back on their head. Real funky, real high up.
So what does that give them as far as an advantage?
They've got almost a 365 degree.
Well, that's crazy.
360 degree. Yeah, 365 degree. Wow, amazing. Even better. Yeah, 360 degree view almost.
And Jeremy, how do they taste? I know you've eaten most everything.
You know, woodcock, I don't think I have eaten many.
No.
And so I'm not recalling. And
they call them the doodlers or something too?
Timber doodle.
Timber
yep.
doodle.
Yep.
And they do a dance. I remember this from the bird show.
They do dance and they walk really interestingly too. They do their little, I don't know how you describe that walk.
Well, so it's a mating courtship behavior, right? So right now they're moving through the area and finding wet soils and open ground that they can do their courtship flights and courtship dances. And so it's a great time to go out in the evening right around dusk and listen for a woodcock. And you can hear them in two different ways. And so when they are on the ground, the males will make this peenting noise. And it's the word is peent because that's what it sounds like. It's a peent.
Peent.
Yeah. And you'll hear
that. Is that low frequency or,
peent,
or is it a high pitch?
No, it's just like that. It's remarkable how similar it is to just that simple noise. You'll hear peent, peent, and then followed by that, if you're close to them, they will launch off the ground and fly up in the sky and make this circuitous arc around. And then this really interesting twitter fall back down to the ground. And so they have these specialized feathers at the end of their wingtips that catch the air in a certain way and make this really interesting twitter. Can you do it, Mike?
Not well, but I'll try. I can't do it well, but
that's close enough.
It's tough.
And so if you're really, it's interesting because they come back down to almost the same spot that they take off. And so you can walk up close to them while they're up in the air or listen to the peent noise, then walk close to where you hear that, let them fly, and then wait till they come back down and peent again and get a chance to look at them on the ground. And on the ground, well, Mike, tell them about the dance.
They're bobbing their head back and forth kind of and you know, placing a foot slowly in front of the other. And I don't know how else you describe
it. So it's like an Elaine Benes dance.
There's definitely a couple good YouTube videos.
Really?
If you look up woodcock dance, I think you'll get a American woodcock dance. Yep.
Now, they're all over the place right now?
Yeah, they're coming through New York in great numbers now. And, you know, they winter probably mostly not in New York. Maybe a couple stop on Long Island for the winter.
Yeah.
But mostly really Virginia and south, mm-hmm. all the way down through Alabama. and then they'll migrate north. And the migration in the spring takes a couple months really to complete. And they'll do their breeding ritual. They'll make these really interesting painting calls and then do their little flight pattern on the way up through New York. Some will stop in New York and breed here, and you know the females will have nests. They're expertly camouflaged.
Where do they nest?
In dense vegetation, usually.
So forests or?
Yeah, forests. Okay. Yeah, they especially like young forests, so dense saplings. Somewhere where they can provide cover for the poults, or well, I don't know if they call them poults, but they call them chicks. And so somewhere where there's cover from avian predators, bird predators, overhead, and somewhere where there's, you know, rich soil where there's going to be a population of earthworms to feed on.
Interesting. Well, this is I'm going to have to listen for these now. And when can I stop listening for them? When are they out of the area?
Ooh, when will they stop?
They'll be here all summer?
Yeah, they'll be here all summer. Now, the breeding calls will probably start to peter off by late May, I would say. They're going to be done. But yeah, they could lay nests all the way through.
Warm evenings are great.
Warm evenings, and you really should be near a field. So
okay.
They really like long grassy fields or a recent clear cut even. Hmm. But yeah, mature forest, you probably won't hear them.
Okie doke. Yeah. Let's go. Well, we'll go back to the phones in a moment. A couple of emails here. 800-348-2551. Michael Muthersbaugh and Jeremy Hurst join us. This is from someone named Forager Guy. So I do a lot of foraging, says Forager Guy. And in the spring, one of my indicators for finding morel mushrooms is when I stumble on a turkey nest. Those things always scare the heck out of me. But I've noticed over the years that if I find a turkey nest, I know that the mushrooms I'm looking for should also be up. So I have also noticed that the time of year that I find these nests, and therefore mushrooms, seems to have been creeping up in time. Whereas around 2010, right around Mother's Day would be a typical time for me to stumble on this. But more recently, I seem to be hitting them around May 1st or late April. Just wondering if it's purely anecdotal or if the progression of spring has moved up by a few weeks. I live in the Hudson Valley in Ulster County near the Hudson River, and that's from Forager Guy.
It is possible that turkeys may be nesting slightly earlier as, you know, the climate change happens, and especially from year to year. If it's an especially warm spring, they may be starting their mating a little earlier on. Hmm. Probably not enormous difference than what it was because photoperiod is thought to generally drive that breeding relationship there. With
mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, it's possible that it could be creeping up a little bit, but probably still mostly driven by amount of daylight.
All right, and this last email for now, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from Kevin. I was once told that bears are afraid of dogs regardless of the size of the dog. Any truth to that?
Nope.
How do you know?
Well, because bears sometimes eat dogs.
You're kidding me. I thought they were vegetarians.
Sometimes, but they're more omnivores, and they do eat meat. Now, generally, a large dog is going to be more of a competitor for bears, and oftentimes, if bears are involved with dogs, it's because the dog was the aggressor and the bear is being defensive. Dogs generally are a little careless and reckless with wildlife and may charge after a bear, and a bear's not going to take that kindly. There are some dog breeds that are specifically bred to chase bears and to track bears, and so those historically have been used in some places where it's lawful to hunt bears. That's not lawful in New York. But we do sometimes use different dog breeds to help chase bears out of cornfields or to track a bear.
What breeds?
These would be black-mouthed yellow curs, and some walkers are good for
hounds.
Chasing bears,
yep.
Hounds in general. But anyone with a small dog that is off-leash in bear country is at risk.
Really?
So I
would
say,
now I have a reason to be terrified. What about small children?
No.
Will they eat small children?
So I would say it's always wise to have the bear on leash.
Yeah.
That would be tricky. Yeah. Always wise to have the dog on leash if you're recreating with your dog in bear country. Mm. And keep it close to you so that you can help provide.
These are black bears and not grizzly bears you're talking about. You're talking about.
Same would be true for grizzlies, but we don't have grizzlies in New York.
No, but I mean, grizzlies are notoriously sort of big and nasty. And these
grizzlies are certainly bigger bears than our black bears.
But the black bears are equally.
Well,
they have issues.
Yeah, I mean, if a dog starts barking at them, especially a female with cubs, yeah. a sow with cubs, could get defensive, whether it was a person, okay. a dog, something barking.
Yeah,
at them.
And we don't find bear conflicts with dogs very frequently, but it can occur. And really, the real challenge is when a dog is running off leash in the woods and the owner is walking up the trail behind it, and the dog comes back with the bear that's chasing it because the dog ran up and started harassing the bear. The bear's just reacting to the dog's presence and maybe trying to defend itself. But they can, you know, switch that gear from defense to, oh, here's a free food source that just came running up to me.
Oh, boy.
And so we want to avoid that by having the dog stay on leash with the owner.
Jeremy Hurst and Michael Muthersbaugh from the New York State DEC join us today. Let's go back to our phones, 800-348-2551. Let's see here. Let's go to Carol in New Paltz. Hello, Carol.
Hi there. Sorry for a bad connection.
That's okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I heard about a property owner that has beavers that came to the property and was told by the DEC that it would be okay to kill them. And I raised the idea of transferring them to my property instead, where I have 44 acres and wetland. And the question is, does the DEC allow them to be transported to my property? Would I need a permit, or is there any mechanism to do this?
Well, Carol, that's a great question. And unfortunately, Mike and I are both sitting here looking at each other thinking we should know the answer to this. I don't know exactly. We have staff that deal with these beaver permits in our regional offices that can help give precise guidance. It may be case by case, but in general, we don't relocate beavers. And that's because we don't need to. They're all over the place. And it can be problematic for some other reasons. And so I would say generally the answer is no. We work with the landowners to try to address the property issues by reducing the likelihood that beavers will stay there, making it less uncomfortable for them, or allowing them to trap out the beavers if necessary to protect their properties.
Uh-huh. Carol.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it very much. 800-348-2551. And let's see. We'll go to Adams, and it's Judy's turn. Hello, Judy.
Hi. My question is about backyard chickens. I have a small flock, and we want to increase our flock. But should I be concerned with this flu about getting new chicks? And should I know where to get them other than our local farm store?
I'm not up to date on their policies as well as far as monitoring their own flocks for the disease. Now, generally, HPII moves very fast in chickens, so they'd probably know if they had a problem, and you'd probably see it too.
Well, how would you tell?
It can often lead to neurologic issues
okay.
in the birds.
Yeah.
Head drooping.
And the whole flock would die really quick. Chickens are really susceptible.
Yeah, they just die really quick.
Yeah, Judy, so I raise chickens as well and have backyard flock, and I think the key message for folks like us is if we have backyard chickens, to just be vigilant about our own protections. And so, for instance, if you have your flock that is just running loose outside, they're going to be more at risk for interaction with wild waterfowl.
Mm.
So if you have your flock giving access to a water source that might be used by ducks as they come back to find nests this spring, there'd be a risk for your flock. So keeping them separate from any access to waterfowl. If you're really concerned, you can, of course, keep them cooped up where they wouldn't be able to go out and forage in place where a wild waterfowl would be defecating. And if you are finding a dead animal somewhere else on your property, certainly take precautions to wash up really well and to not expose yourself that you could then contaminate to your flock. I wouldn't be too concerned about buying birds from one of your local farm stores.
Okay, Judy, thanks a lot for the call. Now let's go to May and Troy. May, you're on.
I have a simple question, I think.
Okay.
The context is a family property, 88 acres. A big portion is under conservation easement. and my father dealt with the DEC about digging a duck pond back there. And through the communication, he decided that the DEC was just unnecessary, and he could have accomplished all this on his own.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, and I wanted in the argument, I wanted to be able to give him examples of what our lives, general person, what their lives, our lives would be like if the DEC did not exist.
Wow. Well, we only have a minute, so go ahead, fellas.
Well, just some examples, like so you can show, like, no, this is a really important department to.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you for explaining that, May, because I was wondering where the question
was
going.
Yeah, now we understand. All right, so you have 38 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, so particularly when we deal with wetlands, wetlands serve all sorts of great ecological values because they filter water sources, they provide habitat for both birds and mammals and lots of terrestrial organisms, aquatic organisms. And so they are necessary ecologically. And when we interfere with how the water sources are used through those wetlands, either by interrupting water source by making a pond where it shouldn't be, or removing some wetland by filling it in, or cutting off the water mm-hmm. sources, that can disrupt the water flow, change the hydrology of that wetland source, causing other places to grow up and introduce new invasive species into that area, which can change the whole dynamic. And so we've actually seen, you can say, what would it look like if DEC didn't exist? We had exponentially more wetlands historically in New York than we do now. When the Clean Water Act and some of our wetland regulations came into play in the middle part of the 20th century, we were able to protect more. And so we're seeing much greater wetland protections now than we had, 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
Right.
And that's been a great thing for us. But if we didn't exist, we would have far fewer wetlands because people want to build. People want to use the properties for development and so on. And we wouldn't have any way to regulate how all of our threatened and endangered species and our game species are managed. We would have fewer protections on our wildlife overall, which means that all of us who love wildlife, you included, wouldn't get to enjoy their benefits.
May, thanks a lot for the call. Very quickly to Seward and Kathy, you are on. You have about 30 seconds here.
Okay, it's a quick question. I was wondering if fissures are very common in New York. I had one here at my house once, you know, fisher cat.
Yeah.
Beautiful beast.
Yeah, Kathy, they are much more common than they were, let's say, even a couple decades ago. Definitely been increasing.
Why?
Really across the Northeast, right? A natural population kind of recovery, really.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, because they're beautiful. They're like, this one's tail was as thick and as long as its body and looking so silky. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, that sounds pretty.
Yeah, you know what sound they make?
Not really.
Go ahead, do it. They don't make any sound. There it is, right? Is that correct?
That's correct.
I learned that on the first time that Jeremy was here, and he was a wise guy, and he tried to make me look bad. So therefore, Kathy, thank you for being on the show. Now I can bring that bit of pain up for Jeremy here at the end of the program. All right, fellas, thank you very much for being here. Wendy wanted to know about whether dogs could get bird flu from eating goose poop. Yes or no?
I believe they could.
Okay.
Mostly HPAI is spread like an aerosol, like breathing.
Okay.
So live birds are more of a concern, but I think some dogs have gotten it.
Okay.
Probably through feces.
Listen, if you can end a show with goose poop, I think you've done your job. Guys,
there's
thanks.
Lots of information on the Cornell Wildlife Health Center description of HPAI as well as the Centers for Disease Control.
All right, we'll leave it there. Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, careersintransitionllc.com. Gardener's Supply. Stocked with seeds and supplies for the start of the gardening season, garden centers in Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, online at gardeners.com for more. And Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live and age gracefully with dignity and respect. Daughtersofsarah.org. Well, once again, thanks to Jeremy Hurst and Michael Muthersbaugh for joining us. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Ed Rosen screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Pets und Vets with Chris Dallas and Susan Ciculli. We'll see you tomorrow at 2 p.m.